riverreporter.com, and from listener donations at wjffradio.org.
Good evening. Welcome to the local edition, news and information to keep you connected in the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania. I'm your host, Jason Dole. But only briefly tonight, because tonight we've got something special. It's a bit of a programming change up. Kingfisher Project, Information Against Heroin, comes to you on the second Tuesday of the month here on Radio Catskills Local Edition. And occasionally, a few months out of the year, we do two episodes a month, especially when Bill Williams has a big interview. Bill Williams had a big interview that we aired the first half of on March 1st. It's with Dr. Carl Eric Fisher, talking about his new book. If you missed that interview, you can catch it at wjffradio.org. And we were supposed to be hearing the second half of this interview next week, but due to a number of behind-the-scenes reasons, we've moved it to tonight. So that's what you're going to hear tonight. We have the second half of the special interview that Bill Williams did for the Kingfisher Project. It is a Kingfisher night here on the local edition. So without any further ado, I'm going to hand things over to Julie Pazal, who's going to hand things over to Bill Williams and his guest, Carl Eric Fisher. Do stay tuned. This is the local edition.
Welcome to the Kingfisher Project. I'm Julie Pazal. The Kingfisher Project began in memory of my daughter, Rebecca Jean Pazal, who was shot and killed due to her heroin addiction. At her memorial service, her former teacher, Mr. Okazalik, read an essay she wrote. It was about a bird, an injured kingfisher bird that she found and rescued when everyone else had given up on the bird. In that spirit, our community came together and formed the Kingfisher Project. Since 2014, we have been raising awareness about the drug and opiate crisis in our listening area and around the country, right here on Radio Catskill. Here is Bill Williams.
Thank you, Julie. Carl Eric Fisher is an addiction physician and bioethicist. He is an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University's Division of Law, Ethics, and Psychiatry. He also maintains a private psychiatry practice focused on addiction. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Nautilus, Slate, and Scientific American Mind. He's also the host of the Flourishing After Addiction podcast, a deep dive interview series exploring addiction and recovery. More important for our discussion is the author of the newly published and justly acclaimed book, The Urge, A History of Addiction. Certainly, I was had this thought about heroin, and then the book pointed out some other things to me. Someone is always making money on an epidemic. And in the case of heroin, and I come back to heroin because that's what my son's drug of choice was. From the time a first seed goes into a ground until the body of a dead user goes in the ground, there are any number of financial transactions. Somebody is always making money, and it's seldom the farmer benefiting from it, and it's seldom the farmer, and certainly not the user who's overdosed. And you mentioned, I think the figure was the something like 50%, it's on page 31 of the book. I could look turn to it in a moment. The tax revenue that the British Empire got from on drugs, tea, opium, tobacco. I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah, I don't know the number offhand. I could find it. But one of the points of the massive amounts of revenue that the British Empire was getting off of these drugs is not just that empires will turn a blind eye to the harms of substances to make a buck, although that's certainly true. It's also that because the forces around these substances are so powerful, these groups that I've called the addiction supply industries, it turns these drugs into a sort of building block in these broader campaigns of oppression, where not only were crops like tobacco and sugar really foundational to the British Empire. They were so foundational that they enabled and provided the basis for people to use them as a justification for slavery and other forms of oppression. So that was one of the shocking things, is that across the history of addiction, we always see these forces of oppression and domination and colonialism coming into play, because addiction is also about power. It's about who has the power to act differently, who has the power to receive treatment or not, and who has the power to wield addiction to deploy it compassionately for some people, but then to use it as a weapon against others.
That makes me think of a word that I don't think you ever employed this word in the book, and it's parity. And certainly in terms of access to treatment, we talk about parity, but I think in a larger look at addiction, parity in terms of how we view people that are used, you suggest we've got the distinction of classes, the procuring class and the doctor visiting class. That addiction and inequality seem to go often hand in hand. Any thoughts on that? Certainly, I know we've made, probably in the 10 years it took you to write the book, we have made progress on parity in terms of people being access to treatment in this country. But I'm just curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, parity, as it's usually described on a policy level, it is about treating all mental health conditions on par with general physical health conditions. And even in the time I've been a psychiatrist, there's been some advances there and even some actual laws. And in the actual battles to achieve parity, people are finding that it's complicated because there are all these the buzzword is non-quantitative, which just means, you can't slice and dice it quite as easily as, say, a procedure in a surgical suite. But there are all of these difficult ways of, comparing mental health versus general physical health indicators. And, before I get too wonky, I'll just say there's something different about mental health treatment and addiction treatment. It's not like getting your gallbladder out, and it's not even like necessarily diabetes management or like a chronic musculoskeletal pain management. There's a way that addiction in particular has crossed all these boundaries into the spiritual and into the broader social, in terms of the way that addiction often manifests as a problem of social oppression and domination and alienation and loneliness. So I'm fully in favor of parity. I think one of the most simple and straightforward and obvious things that we could be doing is mainstreaming addiction treatment. So it's more, not only is it more available, but it's available in the same places that people get their other health treatment. Even among specialized psychiatrists, they'll say, oh, I can't treat addiction, you better go to this, funny rehab out in the woods, or out in the suburbs at least, and get your treatment there. And listen, a rehab, I think, saved my life. It was really helpful to me. And I saw a lot of problems with that treatment model, many of which were a result of how separated and non-integrated all of that care was. So I think we really have to work to do the best we can to achieve that kind of parity, even though addiction is not just the same as I think some of these more simplistic metaphors that people like to use sometimes. I think if we run around saying like, oh, it's just like treating diabetes, or if it's just like treating this or that, I think people have an intuitive sense that it doesn't quite make sense in the case of addiction. But I don't know. I mean, I'd be curious to hear your thoughts about that, Bill, because I know this is a big interest of yours too.
Well, to me, parity means, are we somehow, parity and stigma? Do we view everybody? I would take it back. I would ask you, one of my thoughts Let me try to not stumble and be clearer here. And perhaps when you were a medical student at Columbia, did the first year class after they'd had their anatomy course have a service, memorial service for the families that had made an anatomical donation?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah. Well, we donated my son's body. I think I had told you that. And we went to that service, and families are invited to speak and share their thoughts. And one of the things that I think needs to happen is how do we educate? How do we get people entering the profession? How do we get young doctors to be more sympathetic to addiction and what it means and what it requires and the heterogeneity of it? How do we get people, doctors in any practice? A neurologist, a pediatrician, pick a practice. How do we get doctors more informed generally so that there's, and this, I come back to parity, so that there's, let me call it an equality of awareness. Mm. So that people aren't saying, oh, I can't treat that. I don't care about that. Mm. Does this make any sense?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And in a way, I think that's the more important kind of parity, because people will fight over line items or laws or funding and the broader dumpster fire that is American medicine. It's just an unmitigated disaster right now across the whole of American medicine. So I don't think that there's some cute little trick we can do that's going to make it all better. I think we should drastically expand funding for treatment. Let me be clear. And I think we need to drastically expand our addiction treatment workforce, and also research better ways of helping people with addiction. And also the real battle. And the reason I wrote a book rather than working on some of those other things, is because I think what needs to happen is a change in consciousness around the way we look at addiction. Just like you're saying, Bill, we have to humanize addiction and break down this unnecessary us-them dichotomy. That was one of the main things holding me back, I mentioned before. I looked at my parents and I said, oh, they're sick and I don't want to be sick like them. But you know, I looked at my mother and my father and I saw them as alcoholics. And indeed, they had big problems and bigger problems than I had until they didn't, until my problems got worse. And I think, I don't, who knows, but I think if I had the sort of compassion and capacity to be more compassionate with myself, and see the sort of universal human vulnerability there, I could have been more compassionate with myself and probably more compassionate with the physician, the patients I was treating in my, in the early years of my medical practice, where I harbored a lot of stigma toward people with addiction. So I think, you know, we really need people to speak out and share about their addiction histories and their experiences with recovery. It really touches everyone. That's what I'm finding. Every podcast I go on or every radio interview, people say, oh, you know, my son or my daughter or my husband or my wife. And it's each of them is a profoundly moving and humanizing story, but because of shame, people keep it bottled up. You know, of course, sometimes it's not safe. It's not safe for someone to share their own story of addiction recovery or disclose it. It might have professional or personal consequences. But you know, I think barring that, it's really a very powerful form of service for people to humanize and try to work toward this type of change in consciousness where we recognize that we've sort of over-diseased addiction. We've turned it too much into a sort of execrable and fearsome condition.
More to come from the Kingfisher Project and Bill Williams' conversation with Carl Eric Fisher when we return here on the Local Edition.
President Biden has nominated Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court. If confirmed, Jackson would be the first black woman to ever sit on the nation's highest court. Join us starting next week for live special coverage and analysis as the Senate begins the confirmation process. From NPR News.
Your NPR station for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Radio Catskill, keeping you connected.
You're listening to Radio Catskill.
Back to Bill Williams, who's speaking with author Dr. Carl Eric Fisher here on the Local Edition.
You talk about the, and you, it was in the book, and you, I repeated yourself right now, an urgent need to expand the workforce of practitioners. How do you, any suggestions on how we might go about that in medical school and or the training of therapists? And when I mean, say therapists, I mean people who engage in psychotherapy, the psychologists and or social workers. How do we expand? What are your recommendations for expanding that workforce, which is so desperately undermanned?
Well, you know, there's a few different levels along the whole pipeline. I think for starters, it's going to be hard to entice people into the caring professions if the whole system is crumbling. So we, as Americans, need to do a better job of facing facts about our whole medical system. You know, we live in the wealthiest country in the history of the universe by some measures, as far as we know it. And yet people die or go bankrupt because of our flawed insurance system and the rapacious, out of control for-profit forces in our current healthcare dynamic. So I see that myself. I see that in, you know, we get so many fantastic medical students and residents at Columbia University. And also they talk about, you know, I feel like I'm sort of the odd one out and everybody else wants to go into tech or finance or whatnot. So I think we have to get our house in order and do a better job of protecting the nation's health and the nation's mental health if we want a workforce, because otherwise you could throw as much money as you wanted to at it. But why would somebody do it if it's not a meaningful situation? COVID has only exacerbated a problem that has existed for a long time, which is the moral injury of people in all the caring professions, all the clinical professions, well-motivated, well-meaning, but going to work day after day in a system that's failing them and failing their patients. And it's just, it's miserable for a lot of folks. So that being said, that's my little rant about the overall situation. But psychiatry is grossly underfunded and psychotherapy is grossly underfunded when you compare it to other procedural specialties. And I also think that there is a change in consciousness that can happen where people in mental health care especially can recognize that it's not as daunting as they think. I write in the book about how when I was in psychiatric training at Columbia a little later on, we turned a patient away from our clinic that I wanted to treat because they said, oh, you know, substance use problems, they don't go to this clinic, they go down the street to the substance use disorders clinic. And, you know, in reality, we underestimate our capacity to help people with use disorders and otherwise. There's a lot that we could do to mainstream that care just by helping primary care doctors and general mental health practitioners to recognize that there's a lot we can do. And it's not as challenging in a way that there's really high rates of recovery. And sometimes people struggle and sometimes people make many attempts and sometimes there are tragic outcomes, but there are also, if you hang in there and you give people good treatment, a lot of folks do recover and get better in the end.
This may seem like an odd question to you, but will The Urge, your book, wind up being banned in schools because we're afraid to talk to young people about addiction and drugs?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, I've really been following the book banning because one of my absolute favorite books on addiction is Heavy by Kiese Layman. And his book is one of the ones that has been most widely banned. He's a Black writer from the American South who writes about trauma, racism, oppression, and a broad view of addiction that I really admire. It's very influential to me, where he talks about eating and restricting food and gambling and the way the trauma of racism and oppression manifests itself in his family. So yeah, I do think there's a way that, you know, I could go, I have this sense, I'll say it this way, Bill, you know, I go on all these different interviews and, it would be so easy not to talk about racism. It would be so easy not to talk about, the way that market forces, create problems in mental health and addiction. In a way, it'd be easy to individualize it. I can sense that it's sometimes more challenging to talk about, racism, misogyny, patriarchy, capitalism, all these sorts of broader forces. But I think it's absolutely crucial if we want to capture the full scope of addiction. So I don't know if it'll be banned. I mean, there are certain figures in the American political establishment that seem to have no bottom, and things just getting worse and worse. So I wouldn't rule it out. But if it does get banned, if the urge gets banned, I think it would get banned because I try to call attention to the fact that racism and other forms of oppression are absolutely a force in the shaping of addiction. And then addiction is often used as a weapon, or just the idea of addiction is co-opted by people attempting to exercise like racist views and racist power moves.
Yep. Well, I put you up to this. How would you suggest that we talk to young people about drugs, or more broadly, addiction? What is important for them to know, to hear? I ask this as a former educator, and I think it's something that we should be dealing with kids with in school, and we don't. We're afraid to.
I think that's true. And the notion of communicating to young kids and just more broadly prevention is itself has been contaminated. I feel like I've been using this word contaminated a bunch, but it's maybe you brought me to some sort of dark places here, Bill. The notion of talking to young kids and prevention in general has been contaminated by earlier ineffective and outright harmful efforts like the DARE program, these sorts of scared, straight, tough on crime approaches that act as if people can just say no or use scare tactics or punish people out of using drugs. And I don't know that there's an easy fix. I don't know that we can design the right PowerPoint slide deck or get the right speaker in that does the whole job for us. I think that there are a lot of ways we could be doing better messaging for young people around drugs. And when we talk about real prevention, what people miss about prevention of mental health in general, but especially addiction, is that it's not just a cognitive game. It's not just a knowledge game. It's not just about getting the right facts or even attitudes into young people's heads. It's also about all of the converging social forces, like poverty, like the opportunity for meaningful work, like the opportunity for safe community, even green spaces. There are public health policymakers now who are really interested in these campaigns called Health in All campaigns, where they look at things like green space in urban areas. There was a really widely distributed New York Times piece not too long ago, just looking at the density of trees in poor neighborhoods versus rich neighborhoods. That has an effect on mental health. It doesn't directly cause addiction, whether or not you have a tree on your block, but it matters in the broader scope of how people feel and how comfortable they are and what the temperatures are like in the summer and in the winter. And I think that's the lens that we have to look at prevention through, is all the different social determinants of health that go into the way people thrive or the way that we fail to set young people up to thrive.
We're running close to the end of time, but you've led up to something that I think is important. And I know Sam Quinones has mentioned it in his most recent book, The Least of Us. Maya Solovitz has talked about this in Undoing Drugs. And certainly you also mentioned the Native American Handsome Lake. The notion of community healing. What do we do? where do we establish, what do we do in our communities that helps promote healing? And I'm not asking you to list everything, but it seems to be an important component that we need to pay attention to.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm feeling that really acutely, Bill, because, you know, when I started off writing the book, or at least when I got the book proposal and I really, really started working on it in earnest, it was pre-COVID. And in a lot of ways, I was feeling great. I had my in-person mutual help meetings that I was going to, and I had my Zen center that I was going to. And for the first time in my life, had found not just a recovery community, but also a spiritual community that was really important to me. And we'd have lunches and dinners. And I found that not just receiving, but also giving in community was a crucial component of my recovery. And I'm fine today. You know, I can't complain. I'm very privileged. And there are ways that I can tap into some of those community elements over Zoom or whatnot. But I miss it acutely even now, even in, you know, 2022. There's been a sort of slow return, but nowhere near 100% pre-pandemic. So I think it's an active problem that people need to work for, that we need to desperately find ways of showing up for each other, not just to receive, but to give. And it's going to depend on what your community needs and what you have to offer and what feels nourishing to you. But I think it's absolutely crucial that we keep the question in mind, because just to recognize that as an essential human need in this time of continued dislocation and isolation is just crucial.
Well, thank you. Your book is a gift. And I hope The Urge, Our History of Addiction. Carl Eric Fisher is the author. Thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me on, Bill. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Okay, and that's just about going to do it for the local edition tonight. News and information that keeps you connected in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. And I want to thank you so much for listening. And I invite you to tune in again tomorrow. It'll be Wednesday. All things being equal, if the universe wills it, it will be Wednesday. And that's when we check in with Liam Mayo for the weekly news roundup. Liam Mayo from the River Reporter will be bringing us that news update live and in person in studio tomorrow here on the local edition. You don't want to miss that. Also checking in with James B. Huntington for Work Shift Live, the latest in jobs and the economy, all coming to you tomorrow. But hey, that's a day away on the local edition. Coming up next, you want to stay tuned right here at 7 o'clock. It's Ramble Tamble with John Gordon right here on Radio Catskill. Thank you so much for listening. Oh, and do remember, make sure you never miss any edition of the local edition. Sign up for the local edition podcast wherever you get your cast podded from or your pods cast from. Stitcher, iTunes, all that stuff, wherever you sign up for podcasts. We are there. Radio Catskills Local Edition. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.
Radio Catskills Spring Into Action Fund Drive starts Friday. Your donation now can help make the fund drive shorter. If you're ready to spring into action, sign up to make a monthly recurring donation of $10 or $20 a month or more as a sound supporter. Already a sound supporter? Thank you. Remember, you can increase your monthly gift or make a one-time donation of any amount. Spring into action now at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill.
And good evening and welcome to another episode of the Music Emporium, brought to you by Moving Ahead Production. I'm your host, Kusar Grace KG, right here in the place to be, WJFF Studio Control Room. And once again, good evening to all the listeners, and I hope everyone is in good health. once again, I like to say it each week, you know, practice good safety, keep yourself safe, your family safe, and those in the community around you safe. Practice good safety, you know, by getting vaccinated and wearing your mask if necessary when